This is Cindy Hill, station manager for GPB Savannah, and in the studio with me today is Mark Frischer. He is a professor of biological oceanography at the University of Georgia's Skidaway Institute of Oceanography. Welcome, Mark.
Well, thank you, Cindy.
Thanks for being with us today. And I know we're going to talk about black gill with shrimp, but we're going to first get to know you a little bit better. Tell me a little bit about how you got into this study.
Well, I'm a microbial ecologist by training, and so I'm really interested in how the smallest organisms on our planet, which are the most numerous, are connected to the bigger things. And what causes shrimp blackgill is a microbe that's infecting the shrimp.
For most of us, the way we're going to encounter shrimp that have blackgill is at the grocery store when we're purchasing shrimp to eat. From a consumer standpoint, what do we need to know about blackgill? Is it something we need to consider when we're purchasing seafood?
No, it has no detrimental effects on us, and we've tested it even affect the taste. So what you need to know about it is it's affecting the shrimp themselves, and perhaps it would affect your price if you're buying local shrimp and there just aren't any.
So tell me about that. How is this infecting our shrimp, and when did it begin, and kind of what's the process? What's happening?
Well, we first noticed it in mid-90s, about 1996. The state monitors all our seafood process, and both from a health standpoint, but mostly from the fishery itself. How much is out there? How much can we sustainably fish? Those kind of questions. So they've been monitoring, including shrimp, since 1957. That's when that program started. And in 1996, they started to see shrimp that had discolored gills, black gills. And so we know when it started pretty well in mid-90s.
What is the process? What's happening to the shrimp?
Well, the parasite, what's causing this, is a ciliate, and it's a little single-celled animal, a protist ciliate, and it infects part of its life cycle. It depends on the shrimp to reproduce, grow, and divide. The shrimp doesn't like this one so much, and when it gets into its gill, the shrimp responds as the way all invertebrates, animals without backbones, do. They have a what's called an innate immune system. But basically, the shrimp recognizes, aha, there's something here. I don't want it to be here. I'm going to attack it. And that's what it does. So it releases chemicals and signals, and it surrounds the ciliate with its blood cells. And then once that nodule, that cyst is made around it, it adds, melanizes, makes melanin, which is what's the dye that's the black color, and then it releases toxins inside that nodule to kill the ciliate. So when you see a shrimp with blackgill, it's the immune system of the shrimp working to rid itself of this invader.
Okay, well, that sounds kind of analogous to a human. You know, if you have a cold, that's kind of what happens, right?
Right.
You know, it's just we don't make pigment.
It's not a perfect analogy, but I sort of think of it as sort of an allergic reaction.
Sure.
That happens. And we think that when that allergic reaction gets bad enough, just like it can in humans as well, then it has detrimental effects actually on the host, in this case, a shrimp.
So is it affecting the population of the shrimp? I mean, is it killing shrimp?
Well, that's an excellent question. I wish I had a definitive answer. We think it points to, it's certainly not helping them, and it's certainly, all the indications are pointing to that it is killing shrimp. We've done laboratory experiments, and we've seen mortality, death that can be caused by this. We've also measured physiological impacts, so how long they can run for, how much they need to breathe, those kind of questions. And they're all negatively impacted when we see the blackgill.
Shrimp are one of those ocean animals that are so easy to take for granted unless you are dining or you are fishing and using them for bait, which they, in my experience, are fantastic bait. What do we need to know about shrimp? What is their role? Why are they important to the ecology of our ocean?
Well, shrimp are, first of all, they're incredibly abundant, and they have a very large role, both as detritivores, so they're animals that are eating and cleaning up the bottom and that kind of stuff, and recycling, helping materials get recycled. And just like we love to eat them, pretty much everything else out there loves to eat them. So they're a very important part of the food web. And we wouldn't really have fish around here and all the productivity that we do if there wasn't a population like these shrimp.
So we're looking at dirtier waters and a food shortage basically for other predatory animals if we don't take care of our shrimp population?
Well, possibly, but that's a big ecology out there. So when one species or something changes and moves, the system is complex enough and diverse enough to adapt often. So it's very hard to make predictions about what changes that come. And I think that's one of the we often talk about the importance of sustaining diversity, and those are part of the reasons they add diversity adds to system resiliency. It's one of the mysteries about what climate change is going to bring. Some species will benefit, some will be hurt by it, but what the ultimate impact on the whole system will be, very difficult to predict.
Are you doing much study about the impact of climate change on the oceans locally?
Almost all of our studies, at some way, whether they're directly involved in that or indirectly, are connected. It's certainly a process that's foremost in our minds, including this process, which could, in fact, be a response to climate change.
Okay, so that might be a factor. What do we need to know, you know, to keep ourselves informed as people who live on the coast?
Well, everything is connected to everything else, and the dependencies of one organism on another, one organism on the particular type of environment, all of those are a holistic understanding that everything is connected and part of a system is, I think, critical for everybody to understand. And when things change or we make changes, we change the way the coastline looks, we put up dikes and walls, we re-nourish a beach, we dredge a channel, all of those have impacts that are cascade through the system that we unfortunately really cannot predict what the effects of those will be. I think shrimp is sort of a poster child of this process of interconnectedness and where this parasite came from, what will be the impact of it, will it go away? All of those questions are really largely unknown because we don't know all the connections in the system.
What does your investigation of black gill consist of? What kinds of experiments are you guys doing? What kinds of testing are you doing?
Well, we're doing a number of different things. The first one that I think is the biggest one is we're trying to describe the extent of it. So we're trying to understand what's a geographic range. And so what we've learned, it's in the Gulf of Mexico, all through Florida, and we've measured it and seen it, observed it all the way up to Chesapeake Bay, Maryland, Virginia. Right. So it's very widely distributed. And we've done that by collecting samples from all those different places. We're also interested in when it's present and when it's not. And this ties back to the life history, this life cycle of this ciliate. So we see black gill generally in the late summer, August, end of August. It peaks in September, October, and it's pretty much gone November, certainly by December. That's when you see the visible signs, the melanized gills. But we've developed new diagnostic tools to look for it more when it's not causing the symptoms, and we see it really in the early spring it starts to emerge much sooner than we see the symptoms of it. So we're learning about those kind of life histories. And a fundamental thing that we don't know, believe it or not, is what is the ciliate? So we know it's a ciliate. We think we know what general group it is, but we think it may be a new species or a subspecies of something that's been described.
Wow.
So we're trying to figure out what it is. And that tells us a lot. When we can put a name on it, it connects it to a lot of more information that will help us understand its life cycle. Is there anything we can do about it? Are there other hosts out there that also carry it but don't have the symptoms? Those kind of questions. And then we're doing a series of experiments as well to look at the impact of it on the shrimp. So you asked me before, does it kill shrimp? Those are kind of experiments that we're doing. And we do those in the laboratory controlled settings. We do them in sort of more open systems where we have predators present. And so a variety of experimental kind of approaches to ask, what is this doing to the shrimp? What's the impact?
So that aspect of the science of it, I think, is probably easier for most people to kind of imagine, that you're going out in the research boats and counting and, you know, and that kind of thing. What are the challenges to finding this ciliate and studying it?
Well, there's definitely a technology lag, and molecular biology has helped us a lot. So the advances in DNA sequencing and all those tools that developed in biomedicine is being transferred and has been transferred to this kind of ecological research. So whereas you can see the signs of black gill by the black gill, the ciliate is causing black gill, you don't see the microbe themselves. But we have tools and techniques that we can use to specifically grab that ciliate DNA and recognize it distinct from the shrimp. And that's opened up a lot of, that's how we've learned, for example, that it comes in earlier than when you can see the visible signs. That's one of the ways that we're using to identify it, how I can say it's not a species that's been described before, that kind of technology.
So from what you were describing, the fact that it shows up in kind of late summer, early into the fall, it sounds like it, and that it begins again in like March, it starts showing up again, even though it's not visible in March. Is it tied to the warming of the ocean?
Well, we think certainly temperature is, when you look at all the data, the frequency where you see it, temperature always is one of the variables that correlates. That doesn't mean that's the cause, but you can find a correlation between temperature and the prevalence of black gill. We've also done some experiments with temperature that seems to indicate that that is a driver. And in fact, it's one of the reasons why I suggest that possibly climate change is involved in this process.
You described it being right now present in the states from Florida up to through the Chesapeake Bay. Has anybody else found it anywhere else in the world?
Well, it's also a good question, and we're looking to try to get samples from other places in the world to see if it's globally or if it's something that's unique, more regional. I suspect when we really start getting those samples that we're going to find that it's globally distributed.
How many people would be involved in this kind of a study?
From what standpoint?
From the standpoint out at Skidaway, how many people are working on this type of a project on black gill?
Okay, very few. Myself and my very small lab group. So a couple students, a technician, myself. We get lots of support from the staff in terms of building aquaria facilities, the ship's crew getting us out there, catching shrimp. We have collaborations with, especially with the DNR. Also Marine Extension are involved in it. So I right now I think in the state, in the neighborhood of 20 people involved, something like that, at some level.
Interesting. And how long does it take to fully flesh something like this out, or is it on?
Well, it's ongoing. And yeah. I repeat a quote from Einstein, I think, that says that the hallmark of good science is that it raises more questions than it actually answers. And so that's what we've been finding with this study. Frankly, when we got into it, I thought it was going to be a very simple, straightforward case. And it's become much more interesting and complicated. Many more questions have come out of it than frankly we've answered. But that's the nature. That's how science works. That's how we learn things. Well, I do want to thank the people who are funding the research, the sponsoring the research, particularly Georgia Sea Grant and Georgia DNR through the Coastal Management Program. Funding is always an issue. So.
What does funding like this allow you guys to do?
We would not be able to do any of this research, and it's expensive without funding. Most of our funding sources are from state or federal grant sources. National Science Foundation is probably the largest funder of the Skidaway Institute of Oceanography at this point. But we depend really heavily on these kind of research grants. So supporting legislation and budgets so that the government can support science that is the basis for all our advancement, or much of our advancement, is important.
If we have listeners out there who are really particularly interested in this, is there a way they can get involved?
Well, I should say they certainly should get in contact with us at the Skidaway Institute of Oceanography. We have a lot of information on our website about it. If you're a commercial shrimper, we would definitely like your help. And we have developed and we're testing a new smartphone application, a smartphone app that will allow you to input data on what you're seeing out there. And one of the issues, especially when we just started this study, was that there was a kind of a disagreement between what the DNR was seeing in their monitoring programs and what the shrimpers were seeing day to day in their catches. The DNR data set didn't really raise too many flags that this was a real problem. Prevalences were 20 to 30%, something average like that, whereas the shrimpers were seeing a lot more. And they're out there more frequently. They have more eyes in the water. their livelihoods depend on it. And the shrimpers were saying, no, this is a real problem. We think this is what's the problem. And the industry has been declining rapidly since about 2000. Average landings for the state somewhere in the 8 to 9 million pounds a year range. We're now down somewhere around 2.
So oh,
the,
wow.
The
oh,
fishery
my
has declined, and there's lots of reasons for that. We've changed rule. The fleet is much smaller. The price of operating a shrimping boat is much higher. Insurance, fuel, all of that. So there's a lot less people out there doing it. And so it's hard to disentangle what's real, something going on with the shrimp themselves and changes in the economy. During that period, also, the foreign imports of shrimp from farm-raised shrimp has grown exponentially, and that's hard to compete with. I don't think the product is even close. It's very easy to tell a local fresh shrimp from one that's been frozen and raised in a pond and fed pellets and brought here, I think. But unless you have them side by side, it's the shrimp, so they can get the same kind of price. So it's very hard for the fishery to compete economically. So lots of things have been going on that could also have contributed, certainly have, to the decline. But the shrimpers were saying, hey, yes, this is something that's not helping us.
Yeah, no kidding.
And the DNR were saying, well, we don't really see that in our data. And part of that is just the different ways that they're looking at. The shrimpers are really out there in the season every day covering a very large geography. The DNR, they're not able to do that. They also depend on public funding, and their budgets are quite stretched as well. So they have very different views and perspectives of the same problem. And one of the things this project has really focused on, and is certainly a mission of the Sea Grant, Oregon State Sea Grant, is to bring all the parties together. And that's part of what we do in this project, is to get the managers talking to the researchers, talking to the industry.
That's fantastic. And it sounds like the app will be a really great way, pretty easy way for fishermen and DNR folks and just regular old people, I guess, that are out there to contribute their information, right?
That's right. And when with that data, I think we'll have a much bigger, broader picture of what's really happening out there to benefit everybody.